Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Jimmy Santiago Baca. He is a poet, award-winning writer. His new book is called Breaking Bread with the Darkness, the Esai Poems, published by Sherman Asher Publishing. And he will be at Collected Works tomorrow, Tuesday, the 5th of April at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And you will also be doing, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit later, a retreat at the Upaya Zen Center, also called Breaking Bread with the Darkness, an exploration into the alchemy of hope. And we'll find out more about what that is in a moment. But let's talk about your story a little bit. You were born in Santa Fe. You grew up here in New Mexico in a family where you experienced love, but also violence and alcohol, abandonment, and then incarceration from the age of 5 on at an orphanage, ending up in a maximum security prison until you were 26 years old. And you write about this so vividly in your memoir, A Place to Stand. What was it like to remember and to describe all the things that you and your family suffered?
Well, you know, I knew that two things stand out. Number one, I knew I couldn't keep writing unless I couldn't keep going around the prison experience. I knew that I had to somehow garner the courage to go through it, number one. And number two, when I finally did and sat down and started writing it, about halfway through the book, A Place to Stand, I called my editor in New York and said the hell with it, I'm not doing it. And I basically just threw it away. And my editor called me up and said, you've got to finish it. And I said, I can't. In fact, I started drinking really heavy at that time. I resumed my drinking that I had left off decades ago. I went and got some bottles of good vodka and sat down. I said, I can't do this. I just didn't. I said, I can't. And then, you know, as things happened, after being up for 3 days and three nights sitting on a couch, I just, you know, I answered the phone. It was Anton Mueller, my editor. And I told Anton, and he said, Jimmy, I'll stay with you all along this baby, on this journey, man, but you've got to go to the end. So I said, all right, let's do it. So it was just that simple of a decision, of a choice. I quit the drinking, took a shower, shaved, went upstairs and started writing again.
There's so many people who have rough childhoods who don't remember their childhoods. I mean, they block it out for one reason or another. And you seem to remember everything in such vivid detail. So did you have to, I mean, was it all easy to remember? Did you have to go deep to dredge it back up?
No, didn't have to. There wasn't too much proper schooling in the way of that. You know, like Ginsberg says, he said that formal education got in the way of him being a poet, and when he finally dropped out. I'm not advocating dropout. I'm simply using this to illustrate what happened to me. When I was put in solitary confinement for not following the rules, I didn't have books. I'd never read books. And I had never had a job, really. I mean, I worked labor and stuff like that. But there was nothing between me and my memories. So when I was put in complete darkness, the only thing to keep me from going mad was I closed my eyes in this little tiny dark room in the middle of the desert. And I began to learn how to... I didn't have an intention of disembodying myself. I just wanted to go look. So very naively and very innocently, I trained myself to leave my body, and I was shocked at first. I saw the cell from the outside, and then I saw the prison cell block I was in from the outside, and then I saw the prison compound ground from the outside, and I thought, and this is kind of sweet, I thought, I wonder if I can see my girlfriend. And sure enough, I was in her living room in Albuquerque as she was cooking dinner and putting on Joan Baez on the stereo. And I sat in a wicker chair and I thought, let's not even think how weird this is right now. Let's just enjoy it. And then I started going back to my childhood in Estancia. And I began to do that repetitively because I was in isolation for a long, long time, at periods of long, long times.
You found in prison a kind of strength that I found remarkable, which was through defiance. Basically, you wanted to learn to read. They wouldn't let you. And you said, okay, I'm not going to work until you let me learn to read, go to school. And you paid very dearly for that, but you also basically kept your soul and became who you wanted to be.
Well, you never walk away from anything in life that is that excruciating without some damage. But from damage can be born great dreams, you know? And I also might say that the word defiance, as it's normally used in this society, I don't think I would use that term in the same sense. I would use the term defiance in the same sense that a songbird at dawn starts to sing as the night is left. And the more that I got to reimagine myself in Estancia, the more I began to sing. It was very bizarre because I began to, the darkness held more light for me than noonday, right? And it was so strange that when I was finally moved from the isolation cells into the greater cell blocks, we had these big rafters, and all the birds, when they turned on the lights at 5 o'clock in the cell blocks, all these birds that were roosting on top believed that that was the sunrise, and it was a synthetic one. I, on the other hand, was experiencing the same type of thing as these birds were, but in freedom, not in a cell block. I mean, the birds were free, but I was doing the same thing in darkness. I was perched on a line in Estancia and singing as the birds were in the cell block on the rafters, you know? It was really cool to know that we were both in prison, but we both were free.
It's interesting that one of the themes, I think, in throughout your work, and it goes to your earliest memories, is nature, birds, being healed by nature, finding solace in nature. I mean, you did a, later when you were a poet and you were out of prison, you did a workshop where you worked with women prisoners and you got them birdhouses.
Oh, yeah, grants.
Tell us that story.
Well, I've done prison workshops all over the world, and it all started like this. I went up to Tierra María, and I was to give a talk there. It was a very cold morning, and I was getting paid quite a lot. The governor was there and a bunch of other dignitaries, and I normally can't stand governors as such. They bore me to death with their deceptions, right? But anyway, I went and gave a talk, and it was outside, and they brought this one guy in last who had chains wrapped around his waist and arms and everywhere, and he looked like he had just been beaten really bad. And when he sat down, I was talking, and he yelled out at me, "You don't care about us. You're only here to collect the check and to give a photo op for the governor." And I looked at the man, and I said, "You're right, exactly right, because I don't ever want to go back into prison for any reason." And I left, and I slept at a motel that night in Chama, and I tossed and turned all night, and I couldn't. I woke up in the morning, and I went back to the prison. I asked the warden, Valdez, "Can I give a workshop here once a week for the next year?" And he said, "Are you crazy?" He said, "Jimmy, there's snow. It's snowpack. There's ice. You can't come from Albuquerque once a week." I said, "Well, I have to. I mean, it's just something I got to do right now." So he said, "All right, go for it." So I got all the inmates together in the big common room, and I said, "This is what we're going to do. Here's the game plan." And that one guy in the chains was sitting in the front row, and he stared at me, and all he could do was shake his head in an affirmative sort of nod. "Yeah, okay, I met his." It was the old convict code. You throw the gauntlet down, I'll meet you on the yard. We can fight any way you want. In this case, he said, "You're just doing this for this." So that came out of me, and I said, "I'm back. Now what?" Right, so we did it, and he stuck with me the entire year in that writing workshop. Now that led to other prisons. Ultimately, I went to the Grants prison, and those women were phenomenal. And one woman asked me, she said, "Why are you doing this?" Because they were magical healing sessions. I had a full-blown film crew with me, and every time we left, we wouldn't talk from Grants to Albuquerque. Not a word was spoken, and it was a normal thing. It was as if we hadn't been born yet to speak. We were in some sort of embryonic fluid that the women, we were in the women's bodies all the way back to Albuquerque. And when we got there, after like the fourth or fifth trip, I just turned to the men and the women and said, "Do you guys get this?" And they were like, "Yeah, Jimmy, it's amazing." And all we did was ride the magic back. Now, they asked me, "Why are you coming in here?" And I said, "Because I think to pay honor to my mother, who was raped by certain of her brothers, and who was beaten by my father, and who was murdered by her last husband. He killed her. And I think I'm paying homage to her, that in every one of you resides a bit of my mother, and I want to try to give you courage to free yourself from whatever holding you back." And so we just went with it. And I can say that in the instance of Tierra Maria, I was so excited when I went to Mexico City and I came back 3 months later and I said, I called up a friend of mine in Espanol and I said, "We're going to do some pickup shots." And she said, "That's wonderful, Jimmy, but I have to tell you that half of the guys in the workshop that you worked with are all dead. They all OD'd on heroin." And I was devastated by that because I squared these guys up on camera and every one of them vowed that the writing workshop was so important that they were never going to use again. And when I asked one of the guys who had survived, I said, "What happened, Ronnie?" He says, "Jimmy, you weren't at the gate to hold our hand." So I was really devastated. But when I went to work at the women's prison, I asked the warden. He was a great warden, Williams. He was great. And I asked him, "Can I bring in paints and stuff like that?" Because the women kept telling me these horrible stories of abuse, real, real bad abuse. And I finally said to them, "I can't take this anymore." And they said, "Well, do something. You're the teacher." So I said, "Fine." So I brought in a bunch of boards and paints and stuff like that and said, "We're going to paint birdhouses, and everyone's going to adopt a new family. Whatever bird comes to your birdhouse first will be your family." And these are all journals, and I made them beautiful journals. I bought them beautiful journals. And they began to adopt the birds that came to their particular birdhouse, and we had this amazing thing going on. I mean, the women were excited. They were talking about the birds as their kids, as their fathers. As, "Guess what? We have a new baby." They would scream in class, and I'd be like, I couldn't control the class. I'd be like, "All right, all right, all right. It's just a damn sparrow." "No, it's not. It's my baby." And I'm like, "Okay, sorry. It's your baby." But it was so cool. And then there was this one woman. And anyway, the end result of that was that from that class, I now have three women on the outside who are writing books. So
really?
So I had my hope revived, and I had two of the women who were brutally beaten by these. I get really upset when I talk about men like that, but I had these two women who were brutally beaten by these guys. They emailed me in their last hour of darkness and said, "Can you help me?" And it was such a great honor for me to be called on that I emailed back immediately and said, "I'll be there within the hour." It was such a great thing to be honored in that way. Wow. Anyway, so we put the birdhouses up, and they gave the prison over to CCA, Corrections Corporation of America.
Yeah, the privatization of prisons.
And when I got back, they were all destroyed. So I went in, and it was different. It was I had to control the women from going crazy and getting more time, you know, but. One of the things that I've never forgotten is this woman who had done 30-some years for three homicides. She had killed each one of her husbands. During a discussion one day, she said to me, "I have a little girl locked up in me, and she will never, ever be let out, ever. So whatever you ask me to do in a writing poetry workshop, don't ever expect that child to be let out." And I said, "Okay, I'm not going to ask you. I respect that." So I went on, and she was such a wonderful woman, this woman. She was just an incredible woman. And one day, I got one-on-one interviews with them in a little room that the prison let me go into, and that woman was in there, and she pointed to a box, a wooden box to the right of her, and she said, "You see that box? That's where that little girl is, and she will never come out of there." And I said, "Okay." That was about 5 months into the workshop. Well, when we finally ended the workshop, I purposely did not show up because they were having a huge celebration. And I know you're supposed to, but I didn't. Because these women were always used to having a big celebration in honor of a guy. So I bowed out without telling them. And they were all hurt by that. They were like, "Why the hell didn't he come?" Well, the reason I didn't come was because the celebration was for them, not for me. And they were all going to directed toward me, and I didn't want to be that, okay? Well, I asked the guys later, which poem did she read on that last day? And she read Releasing the Little Girl.
Wow. We're talking to Jimmy Santiago Baca. Your book and your books and the stories that you're telling now, they show us a picture of a world in which the people who end up in prison are people who come from lives that have just been deprived of so many basic things. I mean, families who can take good care of them, love and kindness, really good schools. You talk about these women prisoners who've been raped and tortured and beaten to the point where you, who've had a pretty rough life yourself, can't even stand listening to it anymore. And with the men in the prison, same thing. Then they get into prison, and they're beaten and abused and punished some more. And I was wondering, if you could just redo the whole thing, how would prisons look that were maybe healing instead of punishing?
There are so many alternatives. I mean, they just rain down upon us daily. Number one, you get everybody out of prison that needs to be on medication and treat them like patients, not like criminals. That would empty the prisons. I'd say we have maybe 30 million people, and they keep lying to us about how many we have. But I'd say we have about 30. So we would take 15 million people out of prison that need to be treated. And then we would take the rest of the guys and the women who are in there for just smoking weed, get them out of there. That leaves a handful of people in these monstrous prisons. We keep the people who are extremely violent in a secure setting. We do not let them out to harm children, to prey on kids, to hurt women. We don't let those people out to rob people and stuff like that, okay? We keep them inside, but we treat them humanely. Because it is true that you can criminalize a spirit to a point where it no longer knows how to socialize. That's true. I've seen it many, many times. Those people, you have to keep them separate because it's just how it is. The other thing that I would do, I would institute writing workshops. I would bring in yoga, heavy duty, not just as an aside as they do now. I would make it an integral part of the educational curriculum in prison. Yoga, I would do weaving, I would do singing, I would do dancing. I would have these guys who used to be out robbing stores doing ballet for the community. But most importantly, what I would like to do is create a bridge between the community and them, not keep prisoners as exiles, but create a bridge in which the community gets to know the human side of the criminal and the reasons why this person acted that way. I'm not saying we're all counselors and therapists. We're not. But you know what? To stereotype a person as a criminal and throw that person away, it's the greatest injustice to society that needs to have every bit of creativity added to it that it can get. And there's an awful lot of people in prison who are very creative. And you know what? If you teach them compassion, they grab that concept so quickly because they feel the injury in themselves that they're healing other people with. It's so cool to bring a person to sit next to a guy who's dying of AIDS, to get a convict to sit next to him. You see something that you've never seen on movies, a man who's a convict sitting next to a man who's dying of AIDS, and he's holding his hands and listening to the man talk his last words. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And Fleet Mall does that so well. He's one of the guys that go all over the world doing that. And that's just one thing. I would do videography so that the guys could go on and talk to their families through Skype. I would use their ability to paint cards. They do baños and stuff. Paint beautiful, beautiful cards and give them to the community for distinctive celebrations and days and stuff. There's all kinds of stuff to do, man.
I think one of the things that's so important is understanding what the injury is in the first place that needs to be healed. And your story tells of some of those. For example, a man named Harry started writing you letters. You had never met him, and he found your name, and I guess it was a church mass where they just had the names of prisoners who had no family and nobody caring for them, and he started writing to you. And just simply the idea that, or the reality that somebody was listening to you whom you could correspond with, was a huge need that most people don't even understand.
I had Harry I never met him. He died before I came out. And he was pretty religious. And he wrote a lot about Jesus, you know. And I couldn't see it. Because in the dungeon where I was living, to my right was a man who had just killed three people. To my left was a man who had taken the guards hostage in the visiting room. And two guards were killed and the National Guard came in. And then down the tier a little bit were two guys named Snake and JB. And I saw them cut a young kid's throat. And I was just like, you know, when he was writing me about Jesus, it was okay. But I didn't believe it. But I had somebody to write to me. Somebody to acknowledge my passing. I was not an unknown man anymore. One man in the world knew that I was alive. And that was really important to me. And as I was learning how to read and write, he sent me Mary Baker Eddy, a pamphlet that had Spanish and English. So I was able to combine the words enough to know what the word meant. And I would write furiously back to him. And I think after a period of like a year or so, it was beautiful and it was sad. He said, "Jimmy, I'm not going to write you anymore because you're making me doubt my faith in Christ." And that was beautiful, because it showed me the power of the word. And then he said, "But you will be an important voice if you continue to write. You're going to be a really good writer." Okay, so I was like, "Wow!" So he never wrote me again. But then the gap was filled in by other writers. I guess he gave my information to some people at the Arizona Arts Division, and they kind of fielded it out to whoever wanted to write a convict. So I ended up writing to a guy named Norm Mosser, Will Inman, Grace Paley, Denise Larisaw, and I just grew and grew and grew. And before I knew it, for a guy with no family, I was getting lots of letters in the mail. It was really cool. I had no money. But I didn't really need any money because it was a bartering system. I could write a poem for somebody, and they would give me coffee. I'd write a letter for somebody's daughter. They'd give me a carton of cigarettes, you know. So it worked out.
And giving people voice was the most powerful thing, which I guess was a great insight and discovery both for you and other people. And you wrote poems for them. You wrote poems about them. And I wondered if you found out what happened to them after you got out. Did you keep in touch with people? Did you have any sense of how you touched them?
I did. But you know what's really wild? It's really, really wild. I finished writing the second memoir, which is a carnival ride through hell and back, and then back up to heaven and back down to hell. It's an incredible memoir. But the funny thing is that when I came out, everything that I was in prison... Well, I shouldn't say that. It's really hard to conceptualize. I came out, and I couldn't write. I mean, I wrote like crazy, and I wrote letters to the guys in prison like I promised. I said I'm going to write, and I did. And I described the woods to them, and I described the dirt road, and I described the nights, and I described standing in the woods at night silently, just standing there. I would stand in the woods for an hour and then go back and write them a letter, what it felt like to be in the woods alone for an hour. And I have all those letters. And a lot of the guys who died somehow got this group that's going around the country doing a documentary on A Place to Stand have gone and found a lot of these guys that I knew in prison. And the guys that I knew in prison, a lot of them are dying from liver disease because of dirty needles or something, right? But they're all dying. And they said to these guys that were going around the country doing a documentary on this book, "Give these to Jimmy." And every single person that I ever wrote to saved the letters. And they all said, "These letters have been my legacy of love. I mean, you love me, Jimmy, and that's why I kept them." And then when they came back to the house and gave me the letters, dated 1978, 79, I open up the letters, and I see such a beautiful man that I was, that I'm not anymore. Because when you come out... Something, when I was inside, I was so isolated that I literally wrote the breath of God. I literally wrote from that respiration, the exhaling and the inhaling of creation. I wrote from that perspective, and I have those letters, and I can't believe who wrote these letters. Because when I came out, then everything that I was so heartily writing about that I could overcome and so forth and so on then became physical. And I found out that half the things that were that approached me, I fell for. So I wasn't as perfect as I thought I was. And I began to see myself with 1,000 flaws. But during the writing process, you see much, much, much deeper than Rilke's letters to a young man. These letters are so Whitman-esque American of a young man who has no contrast or no parameters to guide or no comparisons. It's just this young man, whoever I was, believed that language could transcend all of life and become close to God. And I wrote from that place. And it's amazing to read those letters today.
We're talking to Jimmy Santiago Baca. You discovered and were sent and were given books and books of poetry by well-known poets and Whitman and Emily Dickinson and Russian novels and so on. And your book, A Place to Stand, gives a sense of the hunger that you had and the nourishment that those books provided. I wonder if you could talk about the ones that were most important to you at that time.
Well, I had fantasies about making out with Emily in the back seat of a lowrider in the Santa Fe Plaza. Me and Emily cruising, you know. And I had some other fantasies of me and Walt Whitman playing poker, you know, me and Kerouac fighting. In the fantasies, I kicked his butt every time. But the books were like this guy named Turgenev from Russia. He'd go out with his gun every morning to shoot quail or something. Boy, that was me. I used to read his stories, man, and I swear I could taste the duck blood on my tongue at night, you know. It was amazing. And then Hemingway was a little bit too, it was just a little bit too offish. He structured his lines way too constrained for me. Fitzgerald I loved. The Mexican poets I absolutely adored because, you know, they're the kind of guys that'll take the entire bottle of tequila and drink it in one sitting. I love that. I can't stand just pour me a little shot and I'm going home. No, 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 no. How much is left in the bottle? Let's finish it. I like those kind of writers. You know, those kind of writers, if you compare that to the emotional outpouring that they give to the page. And that was me, especially not having any emotional input or anything else for my senses. I depended on books to give me color and smell and sights and stuff. So I went across the board from Chile to Alaska and around the world. I read Israeli poets. I read Arab poets. Anything I could get my hands on, I read. I read Emerson. Oh, I used to love Emerson and Thoreau. I used to love those people, man. And Emily, of course, you know, I think we have like 6 kids now or something like that. I hope she knows. I hope she doesn't mind.
A little busy in that back seat there.
Yeah, well, she stayed in her room the whole time, so I had to go upstairs. And every time I went upstairs, there was the bed. No, that's good.
Now, there's this amazing thing that happened, which was you were in a fight, and it was one of those things where, you know, territorial, standing your ground, you had to fight this guy, and you had him, you were on the verge of killing a man, and you thought about Neruda and Lorca and the sacredness of life, and you didn't do it. You talk about poetry saving lives.
Well, you know, it's funny. It was the muse, the spirit, the muse, that I heard when I was holding that shank over him. And there was blood everywhere, right? We were in a cage where they put all the people in the basement or the dungeon, we called it. They supposedly put all the most dangerous people down there. They were. But I wasn't. I refused to go along with the prison system, and I just became a Chicano Gandhi. I just did not want to participate in it. If they didn't let me go to school, then the hell with it. It's not going to happen. And, but you know how life can be so extraordinary in its contradictions? I heard that voice, and it stopped my hand from plunging the blade into the man's heart. And I didn't even care what the guards were saying up on the towers. They were yelling at me and shooting. If you move, we're going to kill you. I could care less. Kill me, because I got nothing anyway. I mean, go for it. But before I went out, there was this black man named Bonafide from Missouri who was supposed to be the vilest man that ever lived and so on and so forth, right? Before we went out, and this Mexican guy had a bodyguard because he was in the Mexican mafia, before we went out, I asked Bonafide, would you please make sure nobody jumps me from behind? And Bonafide, the one that we assigned such a scouring label to, kept the Mexican gang bangers in the corner and said, if anybody jumps in, I'll rip them in half, and he could. He kept those people in the corner while I fought this one guy. So if it wasn't for Bonafide and the Muse, I'd be dead.
Let's talk about your new book, Breaking Bread with the Darkness, the Isai Poems. Would you like to actually start by reading a poem?
Well, sure, I love it. Let me tell you, Jim Mafferture was fantastic. He had the grace of an angel and the rancor of a maddened bull in putting this baby together. And you have to have those two together to come up with something so beautiful. Look how beautiful this book is. And when I read tomorrow, it's going to be just holding the book. It's like you're holding my child.
Isai is your son.
Isai is my son, my seven-year-old son. And it's just, and he's going to be at the book reading, and Isai is going to sign some of the books with me.
Nice.
Because he considers it half his, right? And I told him, well, listen, half the money's mine, dude. So you know, let's not go there. I had my other son, Gabriel, and we went to Bill Moyers in Jersey. We were selling like crazy, and we were all trying to sell. And when I asked Gabe for the money because we had to pay the publishers, Gabe says, no, this is my money. He was like 8 years old. But he firmly believed that all the money in his pocket was his, you know? Unfortunately, or could be fortunately, almost everybody in my life that I've encountered thought the money was theirs, you know? Okay, which one should I start with here? Okay, here's a nice one. This is when this is the beginning, one of the beginning poems. This is put out by Sherman Asher Press, Jim Mafferture, the publisher, and there'll be plenty of books tomorrow at the bookstore. This one's entitled 12-1503. Isai collects dreams in the nest of his palm. Farm sweet blackberry juice stains his hands and lips. Were he able to speak about the blackberries, Isai would simply say the word God. He wakes from his afternoon siesta, flapping legs and hands, a bluebird perched on the birch branch of mother's arm, ready to raid cornfields in his father's heart.
Jimmy Santiago Baca, it's so striking in these poems that you now, as an older parent, I guess, are so conscious and so thoughtful of giving your children a different life than what you had, and just doing it so consciously.
Look, I'm not sure what it is. I'm not sure where the key is, where the lock is. I have no idea about the geography of open heart. I don't know. But I do know one thing. There are certain things like, I have no time to criticize my father who never hugged me. He was a drunk and he died in the gutter. I have complete love for the man. I have no time for criticizing my mother, finding fault with her for abandoning me at five. I love her and adore her. As a human being, not as a mother. She has every right to have her dignity intact and not for anybody to violate that. So be that as it may, I moved on from that without any sort of begrudgments. And man, when I had my first two boys, good Lord, they created a circle around me that I could never go past. If, for instance, if somebody insulted me in a restaurant, I wouldn't think twice about getting up and putting a fork in the guy's juggler. Not twice. But as soon as my baby gave the cry of life from his mother's womb, I would never be able to cross that circle's line again. So from that point on, I had to start to learn humility. And in humility, I learned what it was to be a human being. So I owe my humanity to my children in a very big way. And one of the most beautiful things I've ever experienced is that when the Upaya first invited me up here to honor me with a talk about the work I was doing in prisons, all these beautiful people were sitting there meditating and stuff, and when they brought me to the front, I felt very uncomfortable with that, by myself on a cushion with everybody looking at me. So I motioned to my two younger children, Isai and Lucia, and I said, you got to come up here with me. And they had absolutely no intimidation, no social blushing, no embarrassment. They ran through all these people meditating like if they were on the playground. Both of them leaped on one on each knee, and I hugged them. Then I felt I was complete. I was ready to talk. because I had the two people sitting on my lap that have in some way centered me in the world, centered me in the universe.
There's a story in one of your books of memoirs, Memories, of being in a sweat lodge with a group of prisoners, and there's this moment where they're all hugging each other, and you're involved in that hug, and having these men hug one another changed your relationship toward being able to hug your own children.
It's true. I had been struggling because as my kids got older and older, I couldn't sleep with them, even though they wanted to sleep with Papa. My body had always been nurtured as a weapon or a shield. And I've got bodies, I've got scars and bullets. I've got a lot of bullets. Maybe my next book cover. Every time I take an x-ray at the hospital, the doctor goes, oh, my God, what are those? I said, oh, that's just a couple of shotguns when the people opened up on me. But it looks cool, you know, sort of a James Dean kind of thing moment. But anyway, my body, I didn't know how to hug because nobody had ever hugged me. I'd always used, there was an airspace around me you do not violate. And I was institutionalized for 21 years, so you don't go past that space. And so I had not been touched ever in any way. And 21 years institutionalized, the orphanage where you weren't allowed to hug or anything, the detention center, no hugging, Gladiator School, which was called Montessa Park, I spent time there, county jail, and then prison, 21 years all together. And the one thing I wanted in life, most people want to pay their house off or buy a Lamborghini. I wanted to be able to hug a human being without tensing up really, really bad. And when my kids would hug me, I was conveying to them that I didn't like them hugging me, when the complete opposite was true. I wanted to hug them so bad, but not with the tension of you know. So I worked with that for a long time. And then when I went to Chino Prison to work with the gangs there, to strike a peace, we had a sweat, and it was the first time I saw black Indians, white Indians. I mean, I literally met white Native Americans from the Netherlands and stuff, and we all got into the sweat lodge, and halfway through, when one of the men had to leave, they opened up the flap and he had to crawl out. I looked and I was so surprised to see everybody hugging each other in there. And these were warriors of the first degree. And I couldn't believe it. When the flap closed, I reached back and I grabbed two men's hands and held them. And I started singing. When I got home, I got off the plane, and my sons were waiting for me, and I hugged them. And it was the first time that I didn't tense up.
In the book of poems to your son and about your son Esai, there's a lot about the big trouble that our country is in, the class wars, the hypocrisy, the lies told in the media, and all of these things. And you have this sense of wanting your son, I guess, to know this, but also to be protected from it. And I wondered, how do you give a child both?
It's easy. You protect your child. You know, you love your child. You work really, really hard. Like, I'm in 6 countries in the next 2 weeks at 29 venues or something. I mean, I crank it up high, right? I go for it because it's just like an orchestra, and I keep hearing the music in my head. I just keep hearing it, and I when I get tired, I just pass out wherever I may be. But I just keep hearing that music, and I'm flowing in that incredible orchestra somehow. I don't know how, but I have to go. I just have to keep doing this thing. And I meet, wherever I go, I meet people that are the wards of, the destroyed wards of war. These are children who at the age of 2, 3, and 4 are dreaming war. And I have to come into that space, and I have to say, enough of this dreaming war. Let's talk. And let's dream our peace. And I am like so intense on that. I'm so good at it. I'm so heavy into it. My breast, my heart opens up these huge, massive wings when I walk in. And I'm like, no, there is no way you're going to stay there. I'm bringing you out. Come on. It's just an amazing thing that happens, sort of a blessing I was given and an honor that I was given. And it's my role, and I love it. 3 days ago, I was given another offer for tenure, full insurance. I was like, oh, man, it'd be so cool to have full health insurance, dental insurance. Oh, man, have a place on campus. And after enjoying that fantasy for 3 minutes, I'm like, nah, I got to do what I got to do. Sorry. So I emailed him back, so I can't accept, but I really do appreciate the offer, you know? So while I take my child to school and he's well-dressed and Lucia's well-dressed and I give her a kiss and she looks like the angel herself, I have to understand that there's children that are like them somewhere else that have just seen their parents blown up, that have just experienced horrible trauma. So I have to go to that other side. That's part of my life work. I have to go to that other side. And in some of the worst ugliness I've ever experienced, I've seen the deepest beauty. I have honestly seen the deepest beauty in a child. When you tell a child, here's some bread, sit next to me, no one's going to hurt you. And that child looks up into your eyes. And I'm not being sentimental or romantic. That's bullshit. We're talking about blood and death here, you know? That child looks up in my eyes. I see something that was originally here 50,000 years ago. I see something archetypal and ancient saying to me, I bless you for your work. And it's just like, wow. So I have to carry those two in each hand. It's just the work I do. And a lot of it's in my backyard, in the schools that we don't care about. Let me tell you something. I was in a city recently here in New Mexico, and it was a big fiesta. Everybody brought their horses out, their wagons, their tractors. Everybody was dressed up. Everybody was having fun. There was a mariachi band. Everybody, all the dignitaries came out, the mayor and everybody else. It was a great thing. The whole town came out, right? The next day, a kid got stabbed at school, and I went to the school. I'm a community member, not of that little town, but I am a community member of the world. I went to that school to see what went down. Not one person showed up. Not one. But if you got free beer, the whole damn community will show up. At that school the next day, there was not one car in the parking lot to show up for that kid. That really pissed me off. I was like, man, you should have seen a line 2 miles long coming to that school to see what the problem was. But there was nobody.
We're talking to Jimmy Santiago Baca. One of the themes in the Isai poems is this whole question of Latinos denying their culture, mainstreaming, and how you don't want to do that and you don't want your son to do that.
Mm-mm. Yeah. No, I want my son, you know how the Irish fiercely love their beer? I fiercely love my culture. I drink mugs of it every day, and I become intoxicated on the beauty. And I insist that my children wear their culture in a celebratory manner, but don't deny its dysfunction, okay? Don't deny that there's a lot of gangbangers running around that we've got to deal with that will understand when I talk to them or when someone else talks to them from their own culture and their own color. But gangbangers ain't going to listen to some white person from Santa Fe going there. They do, but I've met a handful of Caucasians here in Santa Fe that are ultimately gifted with that gift to be able to cross cultures. But on the whole, they don't really listen. And so my way of partly healing, and I take my children with me. They grow up going with me, you know. They grow up going with me to places where I have to deal with people that are violent or unruly. And I have to rely on my knowledge of my culture to show them their beauty. Because once they acknowledge their beauty and once they have enough self-esteem, they can start giving that back to society. Because society really does need all of us to give to it. In order for it to be a thriving society, not a stagnant one. A stagnant society recognizes only one class of people as being important and the rest not. I try to instill in my culture and my people that we're all important. Not just us, but other people too. That's a big one for me.
Now, as we speak here in the cafe, there's a cameraman who is working on a documentary about you and about the book A Place to Stand. Tell us about that.
Well, I'll tell you about that. But I'll tell you a funny aside. A group of these guys, Daniel Glick, Gabe Baca, Valentin Sandoval, they gave up whatever careers they had because a place to stand touched the deepest part of their soul. I should maybe say psyche or something. But they left Jersey, they left El Paso, they left Los Angeles to come out here. And on dimes and nickels, they travel around the country interviewing people in the book. They have found the DEA that was shot. They found ex-cell mates. They found guards, lieutenants. It's unbelievable the people that they found. But I made this movie some years ago, about 13, 14 years ago, called Blood In, Blood Out. And it was directed by Taylor Hackford. So when they went out to, and Taylor, of course, got me to write it because of my prison experience. So, you know, they go out there and they interview Taylor, and I send Esai out there. And too bad he didn't have this book, because Taylor would have loved to read the poem. It's such a fantastic book about my son. It really is. He who wrote it, I just channeled his spirit through me. It's got Esai's joy, and he's a special child. They all are, but he's really special to me. But anyway, so Helen Mirren's there, and she says she's married to Taylor Hackford. And she says, oh, Esai, it's so boring. Let's go. So he goes walking off with the queen through this elaborate Italian palace they have in Los Angeles. And after about 3 or 4 minutes, Esai says, yeah, I'm really bored. I don't want to be with you. I want to go back there, you know. And then when he came back home and said, I said, you told the queen you were bored? He says, yeah, you know, what's the big deal? I said, Esai, do you know what you've done? That was the queen, dude. I said, you're going to understand when you're older. You don't tell Helen Mirren, well, I think I'm going to go back and hang out with the guys. No, she took your hand and walked with you. Dude, that's like a great honor. And Esai didn't get it. But now he's like, maybe it was okay, you know? And then the funniest thing in the world he said was, God, Bobby, she has some beautiful boobies. We can end on that. Esai loves good, you know, boobies.
So this film is being put together by a group of young filmmakers called New Future Productions.
Yeah, I give them what I can for gas and for food when they travel all over. They've still got to go to New York. They've got to go to Florida. They've got to go to Texas, South Texas, to find they found this one guy who was instrumental in my learning how to read, an old gangster who used to read my poetry and kind of help edit it. And these guys have no money at all, and they're going just on faith. And I give them what dimes and nickels I have, and other kind people have given them airfare and stuff like that. But if anyone out there has anything from $1 to $1,000 or whatever, you can send a check to P.O. Box 9311, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87119. That's Albuquerque, New Mexico. That's P.O. Box 9311, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87119. And you can make the, it's for a nonprofit, for a tax write-off. Make the check out to Cedar Tree, Inc. That's Cedar Tree, Inc. Every single penny will go to feed them while they're traveling, and put them in nice little motels and put gas in the car. But they're real troopers, and they're just great, okay? Cedar Tree, Inc., all money goes to them. And by the way, if you do send like 50 bucks or more, I'll send you a signed first edition collector's copy of The Importance of a Piece of Paper for free.
Jimmy Santiago Baca. And one more thing, you will be at the Upaya Zen Center here in Santa Fe from April 14th to the 17th doing a film retreat called Breaking Bread with the Darkness. For more information on that, people can go to upaya.org, U-P-A-Y-A. Jimmy, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. You're great. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.